first of all, thank you very much for inviting me to come and give a talk here. My name is Gustav Korn, and I used to, I started off my career as a professional magician, and started off in Switzerland. And when I was about 19, I moved to London to try and continue working as a professional magician. But it was quite a difficult time for magic. That was about 20 years ago, when magic wasn't really that popular. And so I struggled to find enough work. And always as a magician, I was always really interested in a lot of the psychological tricks that magicians play. And so I had a very keen interest in psychology. And so when I moved to London, I kind of realized, maybe it's not magic, maybe psychology would be more interesting. And then I moved towards kind of studying psychology. I did my A-levels, I did my degree at Sussex. And I then did a PhD on unconscious learning in music, looking at how we unconsciously learn about structures in music, and also lost quite a lot of interest in magic. But towards the end of my PhD, I realised that, in actual fact, quite a lot of the questions that magicians are interested in are exactly the same as the ones that psychologists are interested in. So, for example, as a magician, we're interested in how we manipulate your attention and your awareness, and as psychologists, we're very interested in the kind of things that capture people's attention or their awareness. Similarly with reasoning as well. As a magician, we're interested in distorting people's reasoning, and of course, kind of like these are the kind of principles that our psychologists are interested in as well. And so, towards the end of my PhD, I realised that actually, maybe I should go and study magic. And so I was very lucky to be working in a lab where they were very open to new ideas. And we just tried out some studies by measuring people's eye movements whilst they were watching different types of magic tricks. And really that was the birth of the science of magic. And so really since then, I've been using magic as a way of understanding the mind. And you might ask yourself, well, why magic? Well, as it turns out, magic is really one of the oldest art forms known in history. It dates back to about 2000 BC. So magic has been around us for nearly 4,000 years. And over the centuries or millennia, magicians have developed and learned about some really very powerful techniques to distort people's awareness. Now, many of these effects are very powerful. They can make things appear or disappear. They're very robust. So if, as a magician, you perform one night, well, you need to know that you'll be able to use exactly the same trick again the next night. And the kind of experience that you get from watching magic is really very unique as well. So as a psychologist, then, there's a lot of aspects of psychology, of magic that are of great interest really to the scientific study of the mind. But the question I'm really going to try and address today is really looking at what magic is and the way it actually works. And so, at this point, I'll kind of leave it up to the audience usually whether they want to just have a theoretical description or practical demonstration. Okay. So who wants theory? Who wants practice? This just shows you how predictable people are. I've never, ever had anybody go for just theory. So this is really just purely for fun. So this is the oldest trick in the history of magic. This is cups of balls and two cups. Could you just check out this cup? You can hold it. Hold it in your hands. Just make sure it's a proper solid cup. Another one here for you. And I have just like two little balls here. You're like over that cup?
Yeah.
Yeah. Examine it properly?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you
can. It's empty.
It's empty, no rabbits inside?
No.
No, that would be great.
No. It's
a very old cup. This one is okay as well? Nothing has happened to these?
No.
Great. Two cups, two balls, and of course the most important use for this, a magic wand. Whoops. Don't worry, there's always another one just about down here. So, two cups and two balls. Now, for the first ball, watch very carefully, because I just need to wave the magic wand and the ball disappears. Now, this is all about misdirection and attention, so keep your eyes on the ball. I said, keep your eyes on the board, because the board is still right over here. One more time, I just wave the magic wand and the ball disappears from my hand, flies all the way through the air, and you, could you check inside your right pocket? The front pocket. But it doesn't stop there, because it flies all the way back through the air and reappears back under the cup. Now, watch very carefully how this ball travels from here to here. And likewise, this one travels from here to here. They've both changed places. You don't seem to be too impressed by this. So one more time, I just snap my fingers and ball number one doesn't travel all the way around over here. That's better, isn't it?
Yeah.
Now watch very carefully how the first ball penetrates these cups, even though these cups are completely soft. It's just visual illusion. Okay. So, one more time, solid through. Ball number two penetrates these cups. Is that too fast? Yeah? Too fast? Okay, look. I'll slow things down by getting rid of one of these balls. In fact, because it's you, I'll get rid of both of them. The secret is the ball is still under the cup. Now, you're going to have to pay more attention, okay? Because, watch, it goes into my pocket, reappears under my knee, goes to the top of this cup. I just snap my fingers, and they are two. Too fast? Still too fast? Okay, look. I'll slow things down, okay? I'll do the whole thing in slow motion, just for you. Okay?
Ball number one. Number two.
And under which of these cups would you like to put this one here? Cup number one or cup number two? Oh, I can hear you. You can change your mind?
No, the other one.
This one?
No, the other one.
This one?
Yeah.
You sure?
Yeah.
Fred, it's the wrong choice because there's already a lemon. Thank you. Wait. Of course, this wasn't pure coincidence. But the chances of you selecting the cup with the lemon was, in fact, 100, if not 150. Thank you. Reveal any controversy. So first of all then, what is magic? What is magic?
Something we can't understand.
Something you can't understand?
The art of deception.
Art of deception?
It's that which seems to go against the laws of nature.
Stuff that goes against the laws of nature? Now, is that a phone or is that a...
I promise
it's not me. So, defining magic is actually really rather difficult, and a lot of people have come up with different types of explanations, and I would really try and define magic as the kind of the sense of wonder that you experience from witnessing the impossible. And it's this conflict, really, between things that you think are possible and your actual experience. So, thinking back here to the cups and balls, for example, well, you know that lemons can't just materialise underneath the cup. Yet clearly that's what you've just experienced. So magic is not just about deception, because we're deceived all the time, yet we don't really experience that as being magic. Nor is it just about illusions, because, as we'll see later on, actually all of our perception is just a magical illusion. Magic is really about this conflict between the things that you think are possible and your actual experience. And we tried to study this a bit more scientifically a while back using fMRI. Now, fMRI, or functional neuroimaging, allows us to measure people's brain activation whilst I do particular types of tasks. And using this technique, we've learnt a lot about perception, about language, basically any form of cognition, particularly actually the unconscious. Like I think sort of like scientific study of the unconscious has had a massive advance really through the use of neuroimaging. And what we did in this study was we scanned people's brains whilst they were watching video clips of different types of magic tricks. And we had lots of different types of magic tricks and compared people's neural activation to when they were watching some other types of actions. Now, the results are really very remarkable because these here, these are the areas of the brain that were activated whilst these participants were watching these types of magic tricks. And as you can see, they're really very, very specialised areas. We've got an area here, which is known as the dorsal lateral prefrontal cortex, and another area here, which is known as the ACC. Now, the thing that's really very interesting about this is that these are areas that are generally activated when we experience other types of conflict, other types of cognitive conflict. So, for example, when you're trying to sort of like to do a new task, so when you go home after this talk, you may go on your normal way and you kind of like switch on to your automatic pilot and that will pretty much take you back to your house. However, imagine that you have to stop off at the shop to buy a pint of milk. Now, there will be a conflict really between your automatic response, which is kind of like just walking home, and having to remember to actually buy a pint of milk. And it turns out that these types of cognitive conflicts actually activate the same areas in the brain that are activated when you're experiencing a magic trick. So magic is really all about conflict. It's about this conflict between your experience and your thoughts about kind of like how the brain should actually work. And so, how then does magic work? Well, magicians use a lot of different types of principles to basically exploit limitations in human cognition. So, for example, they use illusions to manipulate what you saw. And I'm going to spend half the talk really talking about these types of illusions. Another mechanism which is exploited by magicians is our attentional processes. So magicians use misdirection to manipulate your attention and therefore manipulate what you see, but also memories as well. Our memories don't work just like a video camera that is continuously running. Our memories are based on reconstructions of events, and these types of reconstructions can be heavily influenced through suggestion, and again, it's a principle very often used by magicians. So, these are some of the principles that are involved in magic, but why then does that lead to a conflict? Well, the reason why it can lead to a conflict is because our intuition about how these principles work, well, is really very, very wrong. So, for example, when we look at visual perception, we assume that we can trust our eyes. We assume that our vision provides us with an accurate representation of the outside world. But, as I'll demonstrate later on, well, our visual experience is actually really much less truthful than you'd intuitively think. Similarly, when you think about attention and awareness, actually, our awareness of the world is far more limited than you'd intuitively think. And our memories are far less truthful than you'd intuitively think as well. So even though you may think that you have a truthful memory of an event, well, that might as well also be a reconstruction of the event itself. So, I'd now like to really sort of like address these two points in terms of highlighting really how wrong our intuition about human cognition is. And it's very nice to actually do this here in the Freud Museum, because what I'm really going to be talking about is not necessarily the unconscious, but really kind of like the flip side of this, really kind of like highlighting some of the limitations really of our conscious experience. So let's start off with illusions. Now, vision is not a simple process. Vision is really all about problem solving. So let's think about, for example, the way that we experience a three-dimensional world. Well, most of us, we can look around here and we see depth. We see a three-dimensional world outside. Yet, of course, our visual brain is only receiving two-dimensional information about the world. We get a flat image from both of our eyes, and somehow these images have to be combined, and the third dimension has to be calculated and estimated based on lots of different types of cues. And so vision is all about problem solving. It's all about kind of like finding the best estimation of what the world out there actually would be like. And so visual perception itself can really should be seen as an estimation. It's our brains really estimating what the world is likely to be like. Now, in a lot of instances that is true, but actually, as we're sort of like, as I'll show now, there's a lot of situations where that is actually wrong. So, let's look at this image here. We've got an image of two tabletops. Now, which of these tabletops is the long one? The one on the left, this one here. And this one is fatter. In actual fact, they're exactly the same. And that will only become apparent once I remove some of the context. So once I remove the legs, they kind of look a little bit more similar. And I did this in PowerPoint, not in Photoshop. So I haven't changed the images. And once you then start turning it, you can see that they're exactly the same. If I turn this one back around again and add the context, you can see you will experience these as being very different. So why is this? Well, even a thing like shape, for example, you don't just rely on the retinal image that the brain is actually receiving. You're perceiving everything in a context. And here, you're using your knowledge about perspectives to make an estimate of what the likely size or shape of these tabletops actually would be. And that, in many instances, is actually very far from reality. Let me show you another example. This is a lovely illusion by Bo Lotto from UCL. What's the colour of this square up here? Brown. What about the one down here?
Orange.
Now, once I remove the context, so again, I'm just doing this by adding some black pieces to cover parts of the square, of this cube, you can see that in actual fact, they've got exactly the same colour. Once I remove the context, so even though you know that these are different, they actually appear completely differently again. And so even something like colour that we assume, well, surely this is sort of like a fairly low-level kind of mechanism. Well, it's a very, very subjective experience because we experience colour, again, based on an estimation of what the likely colour actually is. And so, because you are experiencing this square here amongst lots of highly illuminated squares, whilst this square here is perceived in sort of like in a shadowy area, you're using your knowledge about shadows and lighting to determine the most likely colour that would result in that kind of in that kind of experience. And once I remove this context, they will appear exactly the same. Finally, this is one of my favourite illusions. This is the Hollow Mars illusion.
Actually, at the moment, it's a perfectly normal head of Charlotte Chaplin, but wait, as it comes.
Let me just turn this up. So this is made famous by Richard Gregory, and this is a mask of Charlie Chaplin. And even though it's hollow, when you see the backside, you will actually see a face popping out and actually turns in the opposite direction as well. Now this doesn't just work on video. I've got a mask of this as well in my office, and it works even if you actually have the right, if you have a real mask. So it's sort of like, but it's easy to just show it here on video. Now again, this is a lovely demonstration to highlight really how subjective our experience actually is. But because what's happening here is that although on the low level cues are all telling you that this is hollow, you're so used to seeing solid faces, you're so used to seeing noses that pop out, that your expectation about and your knowledge about faces really overrides all of this other information, and that's really what's determining your conscious experience. So what you are perceiving is, or the way that you're perceiving the world, is not necessarily the way the world is. It's really much more the way that you expect the world to be. Now, the final part to this whole puzzle I find really quite disturbing. And in order to really explain this, I need to kind of like explain a little bit about how the brain works. Now, whilst I'm looking around here, my eyes are constantly capturing visual information, and this visual information is processed in lots of different parts of the visual cortex and sort of like some higher cortical areas as well. But processing information takes a bit of time. So the information is captured by the retina, and then we've got lots of photoreceptors that encode all of the information and then send it along the nerves through different neural centers where it's being processed. But processing neural information or sending neural information is not an instantaneous process. It takes time. It's a bit like if you think about sort of like the old telephone conversations, like if you'd have a telephone conversation with someone in Australia, it would take a bit of time for that signal to actually kind of like reach Australia, because sending information does take time. It's not a finite, there's a finite speed to which information is processed. Now, very conservative estimates are that it takes at least 100 milliseconds for information to be sent from the eyes really back to the visual cortex. So about a tenth of a second. Now, that might not necessarily seem that much, but if you put this into a real context, it's a massive delay. If you think about when you're walking, a normal walking speed is about 1 meter per second. Now, if I'm walking at 1 meter per second, if the information that my brain is receiving is delayed by a tenth of a second, it basically means that I should be experiencing the world about 10 centimeters behind me. Does that make sense? So, by the time your brain is actually receiving the information to be processed, the events have just happened. It's a bit like in a thunderstorm, when you see the lightning, but it takes a bit of time for you to hear the thunder. Now, that's quite a weird thought, really, because let me try something. Catch. You did that really very well. But how could you do that?
I think I was just saying you took an action on instinct.
But if your visual experience is delayed, simple things like catching an object, or even kind of like walking around a busy room, should be completely impossible because you constantly be bumping into things. And again, our experience is not one of a delay. I mean, I've never been aware of this delay, really, and I assume that none of you have ever really been aware of this delay. So, how is it then that we can actually function? Well, the way that the brain solves this conundrum is really that we're constantly predicting what's going to happen in the future. And so, our visual experience of the world is really not one of what's happening now, but it's one of what you predict is going to happen in the future. Does that make sense? And I find that really quite puzzling. But again, this is a principle that is very commonly exploited by magicians, and I can show you just an example of this. So, what over here is a ball. Now, we call this a vanishing ball illusion, And this is an illusion that was first investigated by a psychologist called Norman Triplett. And he performed this illusion in front of kids. And he discovered something really interesting in that most of the kids on the final throw saw a ball move up and then disappear somewhere up, sort of halfway between the magician and the ceiling. Just a show of hands, how many of you saw the ball disappear somewhere up here? So, a few. Now, what's happening here is that we're exploiting your expectations. So, what people are experiencing is not necessarily what is happening at this point in time, but it's really what you're expecting. So the way that the illusion works is I just throw the ball up in the air a couple of times, and on the final throw I just pretend to throw it up in the air, when in fact it's just kind of like secretly held here. And we've been kind of carrying out lots of different types of psychological investigation using eye tracking as well, to show how really people's experience of the world is not one of what's happening here right at this point in time, is much more related to how you expect the world to unfold in the future. And again, of course, that makes sense, because actually all of our perception is based on that. We have to do this in order really to be able to interact with a constantly changing environment. And so your perception of the world is really far more subjective than you'd intuitively think. And again, magic works because magicians exploit many of these illusions. But just exploiting illusions alone, well, that wouldn't really lead to a conflict between your expectations and the things that you've just experienced. The reason why we can, why these illusions can be used to create these magical moments is because actually many of these illusions are really rather counterintuitive. And we sort of got such a lot of trust in our eyes. We trust what we see. And so when something happens that, well, is slightly different, that in itself will lead to a conflict. So far, are there any questions so far? Yeah? Some illusions can be overcome, others can't. So even like with the hollow, I mean, like even things like the hollow mask, I've seen that illusion so many times, I know exactly what's actually going on, yet I still perceive it. A lot of these illusions are sort of like exploiting kind of like almost unconscious processes, really, that they just cannot be overcome. One of the things that's very interesting in illusions is that although you're consciously fooled by them, your motor system, so when you're actually carrying out actions, aren't fooled by the illusions. But I don't really have enough. That kind of like goes into sort of like too much detail. But it's not the whole system that's really fooled by the illusions. Similar actually with some of the magic tricks as well. So although people's conscious perception is fooled, actually kind of like the eyes themselves, which is driven by the motor system, the eyes aren't fooled by the illusion.
I think some people with synesthesia, very strong colour synesthesia, I think to some degree, I wouldn't say they're immune to that, but they do perceive the individual colours as colours. Just a way that people use kind of mnemonic systems to remember things, one could habituate oneself so that when you are presented with that kind of chaotic visual disruptive thing, you could desensitize to some degree.
It's very difficult. I think it's very, very difficult. I mean, even if you think about this screen here, this is really brightly lit, but you're experiencing it as black. Of course it's not black. Similar when you go to the cinema, I mean, you see a black and white movie, well, it's not black and white, it's kind of white and grey, but you are perceiving, colour perception is very subjective. But I would argue that really all of our perception is really very subjective, and it's much more subjective than you'd intuitively think. Yes?
Does it change over time? So if you're a baby, you're a toddler.
I think better, yes. I mean, a lot of these illusions, they do change because, of course, they kind of require a lot of learning as well. They require experience about how the world behaves, and you need that experience to be able to actually predict what the world is going to be like. So, yes, it will. Some of these illusions will change. Great. So, I'd now like to move on to... This is really kind of like my favourite topic, which is all about misdirection. That's where most of my research is really about. Now, misdirection is a principle in magic that's really so central to magic that some magicists, sort of scholars, would argue that actually all magic is misdirection and misdirection is magic. So, what is misdirection? Now, when you look up misdirection in the Wikipedia, basically defines misdirection as just the manipulation of attention. But of course, we know misdirection in lots of other domains as well. Politics, politicians often use misdirection. You may use misdirection in your personal life as well to kind of like to avoid suspicion. Now, in magic, misdirection is used to help you experience a magical effect. And Peter Lamont and Richard Wiseman came up with, I think, quite a nice sort of a very basic framework of misdirection, which basically argues that misdirection is all about preventing you from seeing something whilst still experiencing an effect. And I think this is really very, very important. Because for misdirection to work, it's not enough to just prevent you from seeing something. You must still experience the magical effect. So, for example, if I go, look back there, and then when you look back, a little elephant has appeared on my table, well, that's not magic. Like, you might be surprised how I can keep an elephant underneath the table, but it's not magic itself, because, of course, you've got an explanation as to how this happened, and so we don't have that all necessary conflict. So, for misdirection to work, really, we need to exploit principles that seem really quite counterintuitive. And it turns out that actually visual perception is a primary candidate to be exploited. Because our experience of the visual world is really so, so different to our actual representations. So, when I'm looking around here, I kind of feel like I'm aware of most of the things that are going on around me. Who shares that experience? Yeah, I think most of us do. And you kind of, you think, well, I kind of know what's really going on around me. And this popular view of vision is so dominant that we even find it in some really prominent textbooks on visual perception. So this is a book by Professor Frisby on visual perception, kind of just talking about really how the visual system works. And you've got a picture out here. I have no idea why it's got to be a picture of a naked woman. It's always very embarrassing if I give this talk for younger kids. But so you've got the world out here. He seems to be looking at these kind of like lovely pictures. The image is captured on the eye. And then a complete representation with all her details is stored somewhere in the visual cortex. And I think that really captures our experience of the world. But in actual fact, this is really very, very wrong. Because we are far less aware of our environments than our intuition would really suggest. And this is really nicely demonstrated through a very powerful demonstration which is known as change blindness. This was developed by a good friend of mine, Ron Renzink, back in the 90s. And it's a very simple experiment. So how many of you have played Spot the Difference? Most of us are aware of that game. And it's often actually surprisingly difficult to spot the differences in these tasks. Now this is really exactly the same as spot a difference, but the only difference is that rather than presenting the pictures next to each other, the pictures are going to be presented in succession. So you'll see one picture, a quick flash, and then the picture that's been changed. And what I'd like you to do now is I'd like to just hold up your hand once you spot the difference. Okay? It's just one. can't be that hard.
Yeah.
Check out the bar back here.
Yeah.
It's a whopping big difference. It's a whopping big difference. Yeah, you didn't see it. Well, you're not alone. Most people really struggle to spot the difference. Once you actually see it, well, it's really very, very obvious. You think, well, how could I have missed it in the first place? So, these kind of tasks should be really, really simple. If we process all of the visual information, well, it should be easy peasy. All you have to do is you have to just compare two images. You don't even need that much processing or that much memory, really, to be able to do a task like this. Yet, we can't do it. Now, you might think, well, this is really rather artificial. But this is a lovely study by Dan Simons on an American campus. And what you'll see here is an experimenter asking this person for instructions. She's clearly looking at the person. Yeah. One completely fails to notice that it's been changed. Now you might think, well, this could only happen to America. It would never happen. It doesn't. Like, one of my PhD students, he carried out similar kind of studies at Spitalfields Market where they changed a person for a mannequin. And most people didn't notice that they were talking to a mannequin. Well, most of the participants, the mannequin even changed race as well, yet they didn't notice. So again, intuitively you think, well, surely I should be able to see this. But in actual fact, you really, really don't. How many of you seen this? Has anybody not seen this? Okay, so great. It's quite rare to be able to show this. This is a very famous demonstration now. So this is a study carried out by Simons and Chabris. And what I'm going to show you now are two teams of basketball players, and they're going to pass a basketball from one player to the next. And what I'd like you to do is keep a count of the number of times that the white team passes the ball. And they're going to do two different types of counts. One of them is a direct count, direct pass. The other one is a bounce pass. So I'd like you to keep two separate counts for the bounce passes and the direct passes. I know it's quite hard. Don't give up. I need to ask you just to be completely silent throughout this. Okay? You ready? Yeah, okay. Okay, you can stop counting. Now, it's got nothing to do with the counting. How many of you did not notice the gorilla walking across? quite a few. Let me play exactly the same clip. Okay, it's really nice to be able to do this for lots of students. Most of the students have already seen this. It's a very famous illusion. Now, so what happens is about 60% of people fail to notice this gorilla, although this is happening right in front of your eyes. And again, you sort of think, well, surely I should be able to see this. So why is it then that our experience of the world is really so limited? Well, the reason for this is that processing visual information requires lots of resources. It's very, very expensive. And so rather than processing all of the visual information, the visual system just systematically selects the information that is of importance. And this selection process happens on lots of different levels. So one of them is through eye movements. And so in order to be able to understand this, we just need to learn a little bit about how the eyes work. So vision works whereby if you've got an object out in the world, the image of this object is projected through the lens onto the back of our eyes, which is known as the retina. And the retina is covered in thousands of little photoreceptors, which encode all of the visual information and then send it through the optic nerve to these different visual areas that we looked at before. Now, people often compare the eyes to the camera, and that analogy does make some sense, where you've got the lens here, and then you've got the film, or sort of like your receptors at the back, which in the camera just capture all of the visual information. Now, this analogy works to a certain extent, but there's a big, big difference between the eyes and the camera. Because when you're taking a picture with the camera, well, you've got the same resolution across the whole image. So you've got a 12 megapixel camera, you've got the same resolution in the centre of the picture as it is out in the periphery. The eyes are very, very different, because in the eyes we've got a very high density of photoreceptors in a very small area, which is known as the fovea. And as you move out towards the periphery, the density of these photoreceptors drops off. And so what this means is that it's a bit like having your 12 megapixel camera in the fovea, and now in the periphery you've got like a really cheap mobile phone camera. I can hardly say this anymore because all mobile phone cameras have got so good, but it's really kind of like, imagine like your sort of 10-year-old mobile phone camera. And so, although our experience of the world is sort of like one of rich sensory detail, the actual information that the brain receives is really much more like this. This area of the fovea is very small, so if you stretch out your thumb, the fovea covers your thumb. It's a very, very small area. Whilst out of the periphery, everything is blurred. To make things worse, I find this really very, very difficult to get my head around. We don't actually have many colour receptors out in the periphery. So this information out here is actually pretty much black and white. Yeah, as I'm looking around here, I see colour everywhere. I'm not aware of this impoverished peripheral vision. But I do magic, I've studied this for many, many years. I cannot comprehend it. Like, through introspection, I can't imagine really how impoverished our vision actually is. Now, the reason for this is that our visual system is making full use of this little fovea by continuously moving it around. So we're constantly moving our eyes. We move our eyes about 3 times per second. And these eye movements are far from random. So unconsciously, our visual system is actually already picking out the stuff that is of importance and therefore using the fovea really to its full potential. And that's really why our conscious experience is one of sort of like rich sensory detail, when in actual fact it's really much more, it's actually much more like this. But this need to reduce the amount of information that is being processed doesn't just stop at the eyes. So further along the visual pathway, there's lots of other areas that are responsible for really filtering out lots of the irrelevant information. So there's a massive pressure really on only processing the information that is actually attended to, or the information that is of importance, and everything else is really kind of like gotten rid of and we don't really process anymore. So what's this got to do with magic, you might think? Well, here's time for a quick little magic trick. What I'm going to do now is I'm going to use the power of suggestion to get you all to think of the same card. Try and resist it, okay? So think of either card number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or 6. You got one? Yeah? I'm now going to remove your card. You said I get? Show of hands? Wow. Wow, definitely above chance. Yours too. The house is done. Yeah, they've all changed, okay? But again, most people don't notice this, which again highlights really how you won't accept. You just, even though I've told you about change blindness, you just do not accept this limited representation. I've got this on my website, and I've had emails from people kind of like asking, I've done it 3 times, I've done it from the kitchen, and it still works. How does it work? Well, they've all changed. But we're so reluctant to accept these cognitive limitations that sometimes we're even more willing to accept the magical explanation for what we've just experienced. So this is really just simple change blindness. Now, of course, change blindness, well, these kind of change blindness relies on having PowerPoints, and magic dates much further. I wasn't lying when I was saying that this is the oldest trick in magic. It really is, and it does date back. I mean, it's a bit controversial. Some say 2,000 years. I'm a bit sceptical about whether it really was 2,000, whether it dates back to 2000 BC. But at least 2,000 years. Now, change blindness really took the scientific community by surprise. So when these change blindness demonstrations were demonstrated at visual conferences, the audiences reacted exactly the same way that you reacted, in the sense that they couldn't believe that they wouldn't be able to see these changes. So it's really taken us a long time to really accept how limited our conscious experience of the world actually is. However, I would argue that magicians have to some extent been aware of many of these limitations for much longer. So the cups and balls here, this relies on misdirection. I can't do real magic. What I'm doing here is I'm manipulating your attention, and I'm manipulating your attention to a degree that I can get lemons into these cups without you seeing. It's not real magic. Now, this was known to magicians for many years, and I think it's really nicely demonstrated by this 15th century Dutch painting of a street performer performing the cups and balls. Now, imagine the look of, like, I mean, he's been completely misdirected and fooled. I mean, if this is his expression when little balls appear, imagine his face once the lemon starts. But not only that, he also fails to notice that he's being pickpocketed here at the same time. So clearly this concept of misdirection, it has been known to magicians for many, many years or centuries. And so, in a lot of our work, we try and sort of understand why people fail to see these really obvious things, because that can provide us with really interesting insights into normal cognition. Now, the way that we do this is we often measure people's eye movements, so we use eye trackers that allow us to measure exactly where people are looking. And so, as I've shown you before, kind of like where the fovea is, so where someone is looking, is actually really very important in terms of the actual visual information that is being processed. And so we develop magic tricks that rely on misdirection and use that to really study why people see certain things or miss others. And I'll just give you another example. Can you all see on this table? So if you're at the back, maybe you might want to just stand up. It's very quick. It's not fun. Can you see on the table? Yep. It's a bit cramped here, but okay. Now, how many of you did not see how the light had disappeared? Most of you. Okay. I'll do exactly the same thing again. Okay? Exactly the same thing. How many of you now that, based on your reaction, most of you saw it? For any of you who didn't see it, it was just literally just being dropped. So it's not real magic. Is it? And it's exactly the same as I did before. So the method is really very, very obvious. So I'm kind of like just dropping this lighter right in front of your eyes, yet most of you didn't see it. And the reason you didn't see it is because I'm using misdirection. So I'm using lots of different misdirection cues to manipulate where you're attending to. So we've got this flame here. So we've got a high luminance contrast, we call this a bright light, which will hopefully capture your attention. I then pretend to take the flame. I use social cues, so these gaze social cues, very important in misdirection. So I'm looking at the hand over here. Now this is the point at which I really want to make sure that none of you are attending to the light. So I'm using my gaze to direct your interest over here. We've got sound, and we've got movement as well. Everything put together to hopefully prevent you from actually seeing the light and being dropped. So in some ways it's exactly the same like the gorilla illusion before, where most people don't see the gorilla. That's the end down here. So most people don't see the gorilla, even though this is happening right in front of people's eyes. Now, by measuring people's eye movements, we can sort of start learning, and we can learn as to why they fail these really obvious things. And so this is one of the early studies. It's a misdirection. Here it involves a cigarette as well. So the early studies made a cigarette and the light disappeared. I've simplified it now. And as you can see here, this little dot here, this is the person's eye movements. And if you think back at the fovea, this is really sort of like the size of the fovea. Just watch what happens. So as you can see, these eye movements are really very, very specific. There's really no wasting of resources, but more importantly, this person is beautifully being misdirected and doesn't see how the lighter or the cigarette are being dropped. And so by studying where people look, we can gain more insights into our conscious experience. So what I've done here in one of these studies, I've split the participants between those who missed the cigarette and those who didn't. Now, based on the show of hands, how many of you think these were the participants who missed the cigarette? One, how many of you think these are the ones who missed it? How many of you are unsure? Most unsure. Now, just looking at it, I was really very unsure as well. But in actual fact, these were the ones who missed it, and these were the ones who didn't. Now, this is really very surprising, because everything I've told you before, really, about the importance of the eyes, we'd expect that, especially you've got a person here who's looking really right at the cigarette, yet this person just clearly doesn't see it. Now, we found this over and over again, in that there's actually often very little relationship between where someone is looking and what they're actually seeing. So there's many situations where people are actually just looking at something, yet they're still not seeing it. Now, this is really very puzzling, but as we're learning more about how attention works, we've come to learn that a lot of these covert attentional processes are really very, very important in terms of determining what information is being processed. And there's a lot of instances, really, where people are looking at things, yet they still don't see it. So, a lot of accident reports, for example, state that the person was looking at the car right in front of them, yet they just clearly did not see it. And the reason why they didn't see it is, well, they were distracted. They weren't actually attending to it. Now, hopefully, from all of the demonstrations that I've shown you here, like with the misdirection or with the gorilla, you'll realise that even though you think that you should be able to see the car in front of you, well, if your attention is not there, well, you just won't. I mean, if you don't see a gorilla, you're not going to see a car. And actually, in fact, there are studies that are being carried out on pilots as well, where they use these kind of paradigms in a flight simulator to artificially place a jumbo jet onto the runway that they were going to land their plane. And most pilots did not see the jumbo and would have landed right on top. Because we just do not see things that we don't necessarily expect, or the things that don't attract our attention. Sorry?
Is that where the word autopilot comes from?
Well, no, I mean, I guess an autopilot will probably notice it. It's more that it's actually very, very rare. It's very rare for another plane to be on the runway when you're landing a plane, luckily. It's an event. I mean, it does happen, but it's very rare. And so we're very bad at spotting rare events. Like, if you're driving around London, you're more likely to notice a car pulling out because, well, this happens all the time, so you are monitoring for this. But for things that you're not expecting, things that you're not monitoring, it's very unlikely that you're actually going to be able to see it. And of course, this has got really big practical implications. So think about the use of mobile phones, for example. Now, currently, we're not allowed to use a mobile phone whilst driving, but you're completely okay to use a hands-free set. Now, this is the most ridiculous legislation in terms of road safety, because actually driving with a hands-free set is just as dangerous as it is with a handheld set. Because the reason why you're getting distracted is not because you're fiddling around with a phone, it's because your attention and resources are being used up by talking to someone. And so even though your eyes may be on the road, well, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be able to see it. And so a lot of this work on misdirection has really been illustrating how powerful attention really is in terms of determining what you are seeing. But I think most importantly, it also highlights this dissociation really between where you're looking and what you see. And I guess in terms of magic and sort of like challenging some of these assumptions, it kind of like it challenges our assumptions about cognition on two levels. On one, you think you're aware of much more than you really are. But I think very importantly as well, it challenges this assumption that simply by looking at something, you should be able to see it. And I think this has got very important real-world implications. So think about Google Glasses, for example. Like Google Glasses, or a version of Google Glasses, are going to come on the market fairly soon. And that means that people are going to be walking around with displays that are constantly flashing messages up, so you can have a text message whilst walking around. Now, intuitively, you might think, well, surely I can multitask. I'm okay just walking down the street and reading the text message because my eyes are still on the road. Well, no, it's not. If your attention has been distracted, it's kind of like you just won't be able to see it. And so our visual experience is really much more limited than you'd intuitively think. Now, this could kind of like leave you with a bit of a depressing view of the brain. But this may be the wrong way to look at it, because vision hasn't evolved just for us to look at pretty pictures. Like, we've got lots of really nice art around here, but that's not the sole purpose of vision. Vision has really evolved for us to allow to be able to do stuff. And we do things really, really well. You managed to catch that lemon. You might think that was a simple task, but actually, given what you actually look at, sort of like the complexity of being able to catch an object, it's quite amazing that you can actually do this. Because not only do you have to predict where the object is going to be, it also requires time for you to initiate a motor response to actually be able to intercept this flying lemon. Yet you can just do these kind of like tasks really very simply. And so the fact that you are being fooled by magicians, well, this doesn't mean that you're stupid. No, it's the opposite. It just really highlights how efficient we are at processing information. And I think this is sort of like nicely demonstrated using an analogy. So if you think about mobile phones, like there's been a lovely evolution in mobile phones, whereby mobile phones have got more and more powerful whilst their size has been reduced. And of course, this has been possible because engineers have found ways in which more and more processing capacity can be put into smaller chips and sort of like have more memory. The human brain is really very different. Like, and actually with mobile phones, we've now reached a point where processors are unlikely to become that much more powerful. And it's the same really with the brain as well. Processing information requires lots of resources. It requires neurons that you need to fit in your brain somewhere, and all of these neurons need to be fed with energy. And so, there's basically two ways that evolution could have gone. We could have evolved to develop massive, massive heads to process all of the information, but these heads would have been so big that our bodies probably would have failed to support them. Then about worth thinking about childbirth, it would have just been completely impossible. And so instead, the human brain has adopted efficiency. So we've become very, very efficient at processing information. And so, for example, when we look at illusions, we don't just process the information that is out there, because that would be very inefficient. We use context to make estimates, guesses, about what the world is likely to be. Now, these estimates, they can be wrong, like any estimate can always be wrong. But actually, a lot of the time, these estimates are actually kind of like giving a very close approximation of what the world is actually like. And it's a very, very effective strategy to actually kind of like to interact with our environments. If we think about attention, well, rather than processing all of the information out here, our visual system is only really interested in the stuff that is of importance. So rather than processing all of the information, we only select the stuff that is of importance and really only process that information. And so I guess sort of like, I find it very interesting actually kind of like, and it's probably like, well, especially kind of like if we, I'm not an expert really in psychoanalysis, and in Freud, but I guess sort of like my view of the brain, it's in some ways, it's very different really to the way that Freud thought about the unconscious. Because although the unconscious plays a massive role in cognition, like most of these visual processes are happening unconsciously, like being able to work out a third dimension, like visual perception is just immensely difficult. These are all unconscious processes. But I think in terms of sort of like, especially in terms of if you think about attention, actually a lot of the information that some approaches think are sort of like are processed and then sort of like stored somewhere in the unconscious, I would probably argue that actually kind of like very little of this information is actually processed, because it just, from a sort of like an information processing point of view, it just does not make that much sense. And more we're starting to learn really about how the brain works, the more we've become aware of the fact that the actual information that is being processed by the visual system is really very, very limited. And I'd kind of like to leave it at that. Thank you very much for your time. Yes, yes, yes. Yeah, that makes sense. It's very it's very, very difficult to put numbers on this, and I don't think anybody would ever really be able to put numbers on it. We are starting to we're learning more about the type of things that are being processed. And it's very, very little. I mean, first of all, if you just think about it in terms of physiology of the eyes, I mean, that sort of, the fact that we don't actually have any high acuity information from the periphery, I mean, that's we can measure that. We can measure that through psychophysics and sort of like in physiology. So we can put numbers. We can put numbers on that. The rest, that's very, very difficult to quantify. And of course, there are different models of attention. And these different models of attention kind of like make different predictions about the amount of information that is actually being processed. However, I would argue that really, it's much less so than we initially thought. And I think this is largely because it's so counterintuitive. It's very hard for us to just realize how little information is actually being processed. I mean, if you think about change finders, so quite a lot of this we've kind of learned through change finders. This should be very simple. Like, in terms of actual information processing, these kind of tasks, they should be very easy to do. It turns out that if you've got more than four items on a screen, we no longer encode it. So sort of like it's about four items or four objects on a screen, which is which is really very limited. But there will be individual differences, and it's very difficult to quantified. I'm not sure whether we'll ever be able to have quantified. All I can really say is not very much.
Is sound immediately processed?
No, so I mean the same will have, same happens with sound as well. We don't know, I mean it's quite interesting, like in the study of attention, like a lot of the sort of the experimental psychology on attention started back in the 50s, and a lot of the models of attention were really inspired through sound processing. But actually there's far less work now done on sound. But a lot of these change blindness illusions, they happen in the, or they can happen in the auditory domain as well. So you can sort of like miss out quite a lot. But we also be very good at switching as well. So when you're talking at a, we're talking, there's lots of background noise. Like if you're talking at a party, there's lots of different conversations that are going on at the same time, and you're perfectly capable of just focusing on one conversation, and you will process very little of the rest of the information. But one of the puzzling things, though, is known as the cocktail party effect, is that even though you have no idea what the people next door to you are actually talking about, if your name is being mentioned, you can kind of like switch your attention automatically. So it's known as the cocktail party effect. And so some information does break through, so semantically relevant information, such as your name, for example, will break through. Similar in the visual domain as well. So if you actually present your name, that's more likely to actually break through than someone else's name. So, I mean, I've presented a very simplified kind of like version, really of our understanding of attention. It is more complex in terms of like the level to which information is being processed. Yeah? So I can't give you an explanation based on the ego, but we call it cognitive load or perceptual load. So the harder the task, the less likely you are to actually see the thing. So for example, in the gorilla illusion, I gave you the hardest task to do. I asked you to count two separate counts for the bounce and the straight passes. That leads to the highest level of inattentional blindness. So you're not perceiving the gorilla. If I would have asked you to just keep a single count, you would have been more likely. I purposefully asked you to count the balls from the white team rather than the black team. Because if you're actually monitoring the black team, again, you're more likely to see the gorilla. And the reason for this is because attention is based on features as well. So if you're attending to something that is black, you're more likely for black things to actually capture your attention as well. So we know a lot about the type of tasks and features and the sort of the things that will actually determine whether something else is actually going to break through or not. There is kind of like your personal investment as well. I mean, like if you're not actually counting the balls, well, you will see the gorilla. So this only works if your attention is kind of like fully engaged. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I really like using magic as a way of studying cognition, because, of course, like with the lighter trick, it's I don't have to give you a task. These processes, they just, these misdirection principles, they work automatically. I don't have to tell you count something, or I just tell you watch this, and they're using kind of like very powerful attentional manipulation to prevent you from actually seeing it. But the same can happen with magic as well. And it's quite interesting, like in some of our studies, but also from real world, from real life, kind of like performing as a magician, the people who are really not paying much attention, they're often the ones who actually spot how it's done. So quite often in magic performances, it's kind of the table right at the back who are completely drunk. And they go, oh yeah, I saw that. Luckily nobody believes them, but actually they're the ones who actually spot it, because of course for misdirection to work, you need to be able to actually have their attention to be able to manipulate. So they are these kind of like these motivational effects in there as well. So I'm afraid I'm really going to have to answer your question in that way, because I'd love to know more about the ego part. I just don't.
You started off by talking about the sort of long history of magic, and I mean, it's pretty clear that magic has been documented and recorded over many, many thousands of years now, and it's also becoming more evident that it didn't just develop in the West, it developed in all parts of the world. And with magic shows in particular, you then have audiences, and the audiences come to magic shows with a kind of desire to watch a magic show. I just wonder whether you could say something about what you think is behind that drive to engage in that. I mean, it might connect to the question you just had about the social habits of spectatorship, about wanting to be viewing something together. And the Bosch painting is a very good example of that. That's I've heard that group beautifully described as the contemplation before in magic. And I think that's what's going on. There's a sort of contemplation on perception and performativity. But
yeah,
it's a successful cultural form here. What? Yeah. Why?
I think it's a fascinating question, and I wish I'd have the answer to it. I mean, I've been thinking about this for many years. Like, one of the conundrums that I have with magic, and I do a lecture on this when I talk about lying, for example, is there's an idea that, well, why is it that people actually really enjoy being lied to? I mean, it's kind of, in some ways, doing magic is not a very nice thing, because I'm just actually lying to you all the time, and normally, in normal life, you'd sort of like think, well, we don't actually being lied to. Actually, it turns out we do quite like being lied to, and we actually prefer hanging out with liars than we do with non-liars, so, because it's kind of a social construct. So, if you ask me, do you want to go for a drink afterwards? And I really don't want to. You're probably happy if I say, well, sorry, I'm really busy, compared to if I say, well, I actually really don't want to. So, there's lots of social, so lying has got sort of like an important social role. So, it can't really just be explained in terms of deception. But I think this probably in magic is sort of, it's just about this sense of wonder, and this sense of wonder goes so deep in us. I mean, like if you think about children, I mean, sort of like the sense of wonder is really what helps us develop and explore the world. So I do often wonder whether, well, the thing that magic is really doing is it's just sort of like it's allowing you to having these sort of like these magical experiences, which may go back to childhood as well. I mean, they're sort of, it's sort of like that beautiful feeling of being able to believe in a world where everything is possible, and it takes you into sort of like onto this story of the impossible. I'm afraid this is a very woolly, kind of fluffy explanation. I have not got a scientific explanation.
Well, I just wonder whether that might be worth something to study.
Yes, and it is something. It's something that we are
spectatorship. I mean, it's one of the reasons why David Blaine, for instance, was a very successful television performer, was because the camera was turned on the audience, so the viewers watching his act also had some access to the collective.
Yeah, and David Blaine really revolutionised sort of like the way magic is experienced on television. I mean, it's sort of like David Blaine is all about seeing people's reactions, and I think that's kind of like more popular in a lot of other art forms now as well. I mean, even news, where you're just interested in what Joe Bloggs thinks. So sort of like that, kind of like that social experience, I think it's become much more important.
Yeah, to go on Jonathan's point, just each other. Something about the socially liminal status of the magician.
Because I think there's a degree of volition when people see a magic show, they're aware there's a magician. But I think when you're not aware there's a magician, if I'm thinking of somebody on the autism spectrum, they're watching magic performance. They engage with it not in a relational way. So in fact, they won't be fooled, whereas a person who's maybe not on the autism spectrum and is more relational with it. I'm just thinking of cinema, because when you go into cinema, you let go of something. It's an act of volition. You go in there, you can see illusion because all you see is fakery. But it'd be so interesting, you know, when people are walking into the magic act that they know they're going to experience. Like they're walking into the cinema they've chosen to see. Because to scan their brain, really, to see what's going on, because they switch off at some point. I really enjoy the neuroscience you've packed this in, because that for me is really right, compelling. I think it's only a small aspect of magic which is kind of adversarial, and it's a bit binary to set it up as being about deception only, because there are, you know, like in a taxonomy of magic, kind of 10 areas of magic, only one of which is the one relying on adversarial relationship. But I'm just wondering, from your research and what you're doing ahead of you, do you see it would be possible to work out how to place a person in a frame of mind so that they, for example, receive a government policy better? Now, the reason I say that is that the behavioral insights team at number 10 Downing Street, the Nudge Unit, does exactly that, of course. And I'm very aware of its work, and I'm like you, also magicians right here, and also professor in other areas, but I'm very aware of that approach. But I'm very interested whether you have thought of taking this kind of metaphor of magic, of trying to decode the neuroscience of how people will let go and actually will go along with something. What Jonathan was saying, somewhere people, you know, will set themselves up to go in for that. Do you see it's possible to condition people so that they would be more open?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, Eugene Zaborsky's done some really interesting work on magic in children, kind of like showing how if, using Harry Potter as an example, so children were showing either Harry Potter that sequences that included magic or other sequences that didn't include magic, showed how actually experiencing or watching magic made them more creative. So I think you could use magic in other ways of priming kind of like certain types of behaviours. I mean, I have to say we really very, very early on in this sort of like this whole sort of like scientific study of magic, and there's a lot of really interesting questions. I think especially kind of like actually kind of like looking at our experience of magic, because it's such a unique experience. It's an experience that you won't find in any other situation, really. I mean, it's sort of like this experience of the impossible. But we just don't know it. We just don't know enough about it yet.
I think we might draw to a close, although I'm sure you'd be around for a little bit.
Yeah, I'll be around for
But, I think I got it completely wrong at the beginning, actually. I think that everyone who teaches psychology should probably know something about magic. I think it's... And I also wanted to say, you know, you've opened our eyes, but obviously we're not seeing properly, so you've opened our eyes partially. but thank you, because that really was so interesting, and it raised so many questions. I mean, I think, again, you can tell from the audience responses how many questions were raised, and how I think probably we're all kind of wanting to go off and think in slightly different directions, and we'll look at lots of things in new ways after having heard you. So thank you so much.